Whether it's a Big Mac, a Philly cheesesteak, brisket, a ribeye steak, or meatballs, Americans have long loved their beef. In fact, by the late 19th century, Americans rich and poor came to expect high-quality, relatively cheap fresh beef with almost every meal. In the era before chicken became ubiquitous and before general awareness about the correlation between health issues and the frequent consumption of red meat came into people's awareness, beef was king. Historian Joshua Specht looks at all of this in his new book, Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America, where he tells the story of how beef conquered America and gave rise to modern agribusiness, as well as trying to answer the question, how long can this love affair continue? Again, the name of the book is Red Meat Republic. Joshua Specht is the author, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Josh to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, Josh. I appreciate it.
Thanks for inviting me.
So let's start with this. Are you a meat eater?
I do not eat meat.
Okay.
The cat is out of the bag. This book really shaped how I kind of think about some of these things.
How long have you not been a meat eater?
I haven't really in probably 4 or 5 years, a little bit more. I have complicated feelings about this as a result of writing the book. I use it as kind of a critique of industrial agriculture as
right.
opposed to meat eating in general.
I just wanted to start it off there. I do eat meat, but I don't like the fact that I do. So we'll get that out there, and then we'll start our conversation. So what brought you to want to look at this history of how beef became such a part of our culture?
Well, it's interesting you should ask that in light of what we were just saying, because I got curious because I had a sense in conversations with people that everybody was a little uneasy with how their beef is produced, but there was a sense that it was kind of inevitable. And I thought, well, that's kind of strange. How do we get this state of affairs where everyone's both uncomfortable but kind of sees it as necessary? And then I just started reading about some of the history, and when you look at the early period, so I write about the period from about 1860 to 1900, there's a lot of really interesting work on individual pieces of the puzzle, but I thought there was an opportunity to try to put the whole puzzle together, and that's what I've tried to do in the book.
What is fascinating, and I mentioned this in the introduction, but what's fascinating is that you're really talking about a time before there weren't really many other options. The chicken was not as commonplace. Pork was not as commonplace. But we, as Americans, got used to beef, and we got used to it pretty much for every meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think in the American South, poultry was a bit more common. I think, though, beef was so important because if you think about a lot of the immigrants coming over from Europe, right, their beef was kind of a special occasion food. And once you become to America, it can be an all-the-time food. And so your ability to have beef in higher and higher qualities became a good metric for your kind of success in America. And that's how it became so central to people's meals.
You talk even in the introduction about how beef transformed America, and that transformation is interesting because not only is it geographic, as you just indicated, but it also has a lot to do with our want of beef, but good beef and beef that was relatively cheap.
Mm-hmm.
That really drives a lot of this story, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. And I think it's also the cause of some anxiety among elite Americans at the time I write about, because they were used to kind of having a monopoly on the highest quality beef. And all of a sudden they think, oh, these workers are spending all their money on fancy steaks. You know, maybe they should be spending less. And so there's these tense conversations about how people are eating. And I think that actually persists from then till the present.
As the title indicates, you follow beef from hoof to table. What brought you to that particular way of telling the story?
Well, I think, you know, it sounds pretty good.
It does.
But no, I think I became just curious to try to think about how I tell us, you know, people have written about the kind of journey from farm to plate. I think one thing I found interesting is as I started to go to the beginning of that story, to the ranches, I realized that there was a bunch of land that this all depended on. And I started to think, well, where did this come from? And so one piece of the story that I think is very important is the dispossession or taking of American Indian land through war and that connection to our industrial food. But I think it's a really nice way to kind of give you a thread to hold on to as I give you kind of an overall picture of all these different facets of American history during the period.
So let's go a little bit further into that. The entire first section of the book is about war. So what was it about war and about our battles that brought us to this point?
Well, I think that that's an interesting question. I think that that's kind of what rooted Americanness in a way so closely in this idea about consuming beef. So if you think about the American West and what people have kind of called the frontier as a space of violence, but also kind of creating the U.S. in idea and reality, and then you think about the fact that ranching is so important to those spaces, what you realize is the production of beef becomes at the center of what it means to be an American, both in the idea and actually in the kind of taking of that land. And so I think the United States would not be the economic powerhouse it was without these massive, massive stretches of land that is, you know, our portion of the North American continent. And that all depended on warfare, because despite what people claim, there were people living there and there were people using that land.
Talk a little bit about the, again, about the geographic aspect here, because you do talk about the economic development of the American West. You talk about the range, and I'm curious as to how that leads the story here as well.
Yeah, well, I think the key really to the story is that the United States becomes a gigantic national market. Right. So it's the fact that you could be in Boston and you could be eating beef that came all the way from Texas originally as an animal, or came all the way from Montana. And you need a kind of huge quantities of space to mean you could get cattle from any of those places. And you also, of course, need means of transportation, which is why the kind of key to connecting and building these markets in the U.S. was the railroad. And refrigeration. And so it was the ability to move around all these places that enabled this to happen nationally. Now, that doesn't determine who's going to be kind of the winners and losers in this system. That's a kind of bloody fight over who will dominate that I try to trace in the book.
So you bring us to, there's one section of this book, you bring us to Chicago and their dominance of the nation's commodity markets. And it had its limitations, but it does really drive this, and it drives much of what is happening. I mean, if you look at that as kind of the epicenter, then the ripples go to both the right and the left.
Yes, for sure.
When do you start to see that happen?
That happens in kind of between about 1850 and 1900. I mean, Chicago is one of the fastest growing cities in the world in that period. And by 1900, it's one of the largest cities in the U.S. and one of the larger cities in the world. And what I always say is, to be a kind of great city, you need two things. You need location and you need a lot of luck. And Chicago had both. So it was well situated in terms of access to the Great Lakes for water transportation. It wasn't actually far from the Mississippi River watershed, so it was well suited for trade. Then railroads started moving there, and during the American Civil War, you get the southern United States is kind of out of the picture in terms of industry, and then you get Chicago getting these massive industrial connections to Boston and New York. So Chicago, good location and a little lucky.
And then there is labor unrest there. Give us a sense of what ultimately that the impact is that has on the markets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think, you know, there's a story about how kind of you get industrial food. And a big part of that story is what's known as the disassembly line, which is essentially the cattle slaughter version of the assembly line. So taking apart an animal in a factory setting. And actually, if you look at Henry Ford's autobiography, he mentions he had the idea for the car assembly line from watching beef in Chicago. But some people like to tell the story that disassembly line is so brilliant because it kind of magically makes people more efficient. But what I try to argue is actually part of what makes it so effective is you can get so many workers participating in the process, and you can kind of synchronize them all and forcibly speed them up more and more. So you can force people to work harder. That's kind of what made the disassembly line so brilliant. And of course, when people are working harder, you start to get injuries, you start to get deaths, and you start to get workers fighting back. And so throughout the 19th century, there were fights between the owners of these meatpacking firms and workers trying to figure out what this new world of industrial production looks like. Unfortunately for many of these workers, the balance of kind of public sympathy was ultimately with the meatpacking firms, but it doesn't mean it wasn't a kind of brutal fight.
So I want to get into those firms in a minute, but you talk about this industrialized slaughterhouse. What made it radically different?
I think it was the division of labor and the kind of lowering of expertise needed to do it. So the idea is, if you imagine, you know, 10 master butchers who can kind of do every aspect of it working at the same time, they might only be able to process a certain number of animals an hour, relatively small one, maybe a few. If you get those same 10 people each doing one highly repetitive stage of that, well, A, that's much easier for them to understand, and B, they can do a lot more. You might see things be 10 times as efficient. So it's that division of labor that really was at the core of the idea of what makes an industrial slaughterhouse different.
You also, I think, as you mentioned, the meatpackers, we all know, or probably most of us know, about Upton Sinclair and the jungle. You write about this as well. It just, even in reading the book, I remember when I first read that book, and then I just was thinking about this as I was reading your book. Like, how did the beef industry survive that? I mean, I would think that would kill everything at that point.
Right. So I think, that's a really important question. It's one I actually had thought about a lot and kind of struggled with. I think one way to think about it is, if you look at the jungle, Upton Sinclair had one overarching goal: revolution. So at the end of the story, the worker who's kind of been ground down by meatpacking is listening to a socialist agitator, and they're talking about seizing the streets of Chicago. But of course, revolution wasn't what Sinclair got. He actually got regulation. So everybody was so disgusted by his stories about what was in their food, they kind of forgot about his political agenda. And I think that kind of makes sense, because if you're worried your hamburger is going to kill you, you don't have time to worry about anything else.
Right.
But I think that regulation was so successful because this visceral feel in consumers, and it hit the meatpackers where it hurt them most. They didn't want you to lose faith in their products. And so, yes, it looks really bad for them, but it set up a problem they could solve, which is to say, they wanted to solve the sanitation issues. They don't want you worrying about what's in your meat. And so even though it hurt them for a time, they could kind of accept these new regulations that emerge in the wake of the jungle, and then they could try to clean up how their food is, and then they can get people on their key value proposition, which has always been low prices. And so it sets up a problem they can solve in a way.
And those problems that are solved also come out of ultimately what you say, that is a consequence of their ability to make these interests overlap. And oh, by the way, Americans still want meat.
Yeah, I mean, this is the key to the story. Is obviously the unsaid thing thus far is the taste proposition. People want this meat, and if there's a way to provide it that they won't feel too uncomfortable with, that's what they're going to be happy with.
When you look at the effect on the ranchers, you look at the effect of the butchers, you look on the effect of workers, even in various stages of this, and yet this industry still prevails. Again, as you said, there was a problem they couldn't solve, but you would think that they would be just headed for fight after fight after fight along the way.
You would. I mean, I think you do see those fights periodically. I think one of the reasons why is that it reaches a kind of stability, kind of at the end of my story, in the early 20th century, which is ranchers have struggled at the hands of meat processing firms since the period I write about, since the 1880s. And this comes up periodically today. There was just recently the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, or at least some members of it, were complaining about the prices they're receiving. But the problem is, ultimately, they're so reliant on the meat processors, they can't protest too much. They kind of have to give in. Meanwhile, we've just sort of accepted that slaughterhouse labor is dangerous, poorly paid, and invisible. It was mostly recent immigrants, non-citizens from Eastern Europe in the late 19th century. Today, it's often undocumented people. And so there are these kinds of conflicts, but they've kind of been pushed in a way that they can't change things too much, even if there's sort of periodic friction today. So these trends do continue. They're just muted.
Yeah, I was going to say, you in your conclusion of this book, you include a cartoon of Teddy Roosevelt. And in 1902, you write, Roosevelt described big corporations as an inevitable development of modern industrialism and noted that efforts to destroy them would be futile. So here we are in 2019, and boom, right? It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is that I think you picked up on something really important that I struggle with. In a way, in the book, I'm a little bit critical of that position just because I don't see it as inevitable in my story. But then I think today, and I think, well, could we is there a different way we could do this? Could we kind of decentralize this? I think there are some conversations we see parallels with today when we talk about whether or not we could break up some of these giant tech companies. That's an analogous debate, right? Is centralization inevitable? Is it a good thing? I don't think there are easy answers. And so I guess with the book, I didn't figure it out, but I wanted to kind of contribute to us thinking through collectively those questions.
Well, you do say that this is of how we produce our food is a question of politics and political
yes.
economy. We are becoming more aware, though, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I see space for optimism. One of the things I stress in my book in the section on consumption is Americans around 1900, they didn't really think too much about how their food was produced, as long as they weren't afraid it was going to poison them. Since the 1970s, particularly around issues of climate change, but also environmental issues more broadly, people are asking about how their food is produced. They are asking about labor conditions. They are asking about whether there are meatless alternatives. And I think that interest from consumers is really encouraging because it not only will kind of get people advocating, but it's going to eventually, I think, force industry to change if the conversation continues for long enough. So that's heartening.
The name of the book is Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America. The book is published by Princeton University Press and by Joshua Spetch. Joshua, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much. It's a great conversation.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Red Meat Republic, a hoof-to-table history of how beef changed America. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.